I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about how we treat healthcare workers who return to the United States from treating Ebola patients in West Africa. The state of Maine and the nurse, Casey Hitchcock, who had treated victims of Ebola virus in West Africa, reached a settlement on Monday of this week. Casey Hitchcock was to be allowed to travel freely in public, but required to monitor her health closely and to report any symptoms until the quarantine period would be lifted, and that would be November 10th. She, of course, had sharply criticized the way both New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Maine Governor Paul LePage had responded to her case. There are a handful of states that have imposed mandatory quarantines on health workers returning from Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and the federal government is wary of discouraging potential medical volunteers. In fact, the president, who's giving a press conference right now, responding to yesterday's Republican wave, said that after the midterm elections, he hopes to work with the new Congress. There are still things he wants to accomplish in this term, including increasing efforts to combat Ebola in Africa and to make changes here to ensure that we are safe in the United States. Joining us this hour to talk about this issue is Yevgeny Feyman. He's a fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress, writes on healthcare policy, the Affordable Care Act, entitlement reform. His latest research has focused on the national physician shortage and the costs of healthcare reform. And he has been with us before to talk mostly about healthcare related issues. Today, it's how we treat people who have been in the healthcare field mostly, although not exclusively, and who have returned after treating Ebola patients to the United States. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Does a mandatory quarantine make sense, or are we kind of in a panic and not looking at the science related to all of this? That's the question of the hour. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Yevgeny, thank you very much for being with us again. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what happened on Monday. This this healthcare worker, this nurse, has really made a lot of national attention, who had treated victims of the Ebola virus. She can now travel freely in public. She needs to monitor her health closely and to report any symptoms. That seems reasonable, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think the new guidelines that Maine is using for her, and just to be clear, it's only for her. They have different guidelines for other people that are arriving. That's pretty much in line with what CDC has been recommending with their most recent guidance. So I think these new guidelines, if they're expanded to everyone else, are a pretty good step. That's generally the direction most states should be going.
And there are some states. What states have much stricter quarantines?
Well, I'll tell you right away, New Jersey and New York, they've both loosened their guidelines a little bit, but New York is still requiring mandatory home quarantines for people coming back from West Africa, regardless of whether they're symptomatic or not, regardless of whether they're healthcare workers or not. New Jersey is using the same tiers of risk that CDC has recommended. You basically go from zero risk to very high risk. But for any healthcare workers, again, whether or not they're symptomatic, New Jersey is still requiring a mandatory quarantine in isolation. So in theory, you could do that at home, but my guess is that they'll be using a hospital or some kind of makeshift tent that they set up, kind of like what they did with Casey Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those are much more restrictive than what the CDC has recommended, because they have some kind of isolation or quarantine protocol for people who are non-symptomatic, so people who don't have any fever, they don't have any muscle pain or vomiting, any kind of stomach pain, which is quite a bit more restrictive. It can basically affect every single person who's coming from West Africa.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that the science is there and has informed us sufficiently that we know that you cannot contract the disease from somebody until they are symptomatic?
So it is, It's worthwhile noting that what we do know about the disease is based on much fewer cases than other diseases. So there have been only a handful of outbreaks of Ebola over the past few decades. And for the most part, it's been very small patient populations. This is the first time that it's been very severe. So that's only caveat. But we do know how the disease works. We know that, for instance, people who don't have symptoms, there hasn't been any recorded cases of non-symptomatic people infecting family members or anyone close to them. One example in Texas, Thomas Duncan, who unfortunately died while being treated. He was sent home with symptoms of Ebola, where he was around family, and even then he didn't infect any of his family members because he wasn't in close enough proximity. Because to transmit Ebola, you have to be in very close contact with a person's bodily fluids.
Mm-hmm.
So even close proximity to someone who is symptomatic doesn't guarantee that you'll actually get infected.
Mm-hmm. So what do you make of particularly Governor Chris Christie's actions here? He put the nurse in a tent for 3 days and then said, you know, it wasn't bad. She had really good food from New Jersey to eat in that tent and kind of, you know, put her down in a way. I mean, his behavior has been described as kind of bully-like, which I think is accurate. I don't know why he took that tact working with, you know, in talking about this woman who had gone to West Africa to be a nurse to people with Ebola. She was just doing great work, and to treat her that way, I don't know, I guess people thought it was okay. A lot of people did, because he was keeping other people in New Jersey safe. But there was something that just didn't ring well with many people about that treatment. What did you think?
You know, I didn't support. I agree. I think the treatment was very, very bully-like. I'll also say, though, that Casey Hickox, after she returned to Maine, she probably shouldn't have pushed back quite as much. She should have tried to be a little bit more conciliatory with the government in Maine, because they were legitimately trying to work with her, and you know they did. They reached a deal finally, but only after a long PR campaign. Going back to Christie, it underscores the fact that any Ebola response by the states, by the feds, by politicians is going to be inherently political. So you're dealing with people who are irrationally afraid, and there's no way around it. I mean, your average voter, your average citizen, you can't expect them to be well versed, well educated on Ebola. So they're going to be afraid when they see this in the news, when they hear about it. And Christie took the tack of responding as forcefully as possible to allay those fears. None of it was scientific. I think he was a complete bully. The guidelines were really excessive. The only thing that that's somewhat justifiable is they did see that Casey Hickox had a high temperature when she first arrived. She says that that's because she got really flushed when the agents accosted her. So, you know, initially some isolation protocol was probably warranted, but once they saw that she was non-symptomatic afterwards, no sign of fever or any other symptoms, they could have sent her home and just monitored her from there. It was an excessive use of force, and I think probably unconstitutional as well.
Yeah. So do we have a lot of conflict now between federal government guidelines and state government guidelines? I'm wondering if there are other states, or if they come up with what their policy is going to be when they get a case of Ebola. I hear there's a potential one in North Carolina. There haven't been very many here, but do people come up with their policies once there's a case, or should everybody have a policy, and should it be standard all over the country?
Well, it's very hard to have a standard policy across the country. Public health authority is traditionally delegated to the states. For better or worse, that's a federal system we have. And that's kind of the way the CDC also likes it. They don't like to abuse their power. They don't like to go in and tell states what to do. They prefer to set these minimum standards for determining whether a public health program is good enough. And they do allow states to go above and beyond. I think for your average state, it definitely helps to have these guidelines in place. If they're not expecting any cases, if they're not expecting a lot of people coming through from West Africa, and right now there are very, very few people coming from West Africa to the U.S., they should probably just be adopting the CDC guidelines. Those are pretty safe. Those are based on the science. And to some extent, it's going to be in a case-by-case basis. Determining risk status is very, very difficult to do, and there are questionnaires to fill out, there are interviews to do. It's a long process. So determining who falls into which category, that's ultimately going to be at the state level, and how best to work out these policies in terms of implementation, it's also going to be at the state level, but the broad guidelines at the federal level should be enough for most states.
Mm-hmm. Do you think politics has entered all of this in some significant way?
100%.
Oh, you do? 100%. Wow.
It's impossible to divorce politics from all of this. Like I said, Christie took this as an opportunity to be a bully, or you know how some people might view him as a quote unquote strong leader. So it's got kind of two sides of the same coin. For some states initially, I think that this was an opportunity to push back against the feds and ensure that they retained control over their public health programs. So some of that criticism was warranted. I think the initial response from the CDC and the Obama administration was a little lackluster, but it's become less politicized than it was initially, I think. The responses now and the guidelines now have become a little bit more science-based.
Mm-hmm. And what about the public sphere? Has it subsided as well, or are we still having cases of, oh, you went to Africa, I don't want to go to school with you?
Yeah, I've read a lot of anecdotal accounts of people saying that they won't hold on to the subway pole because they're afraid of getting Ebola, that they won't go uptown into Harlem here in Manhattan, where there are a lot of people from Africa, a lot of African immigrants, but almost no one from West Africa. I think one problem we're seeing is that people are starting to lump West Africa with all the rest of Africa, and Africa is a huge, huge place.
Right.
Most of Africa has no Ebola. And I think your average person doesn't understand that Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, they're tiny, tiny countries all bunched together.
There was somebody who wrote for CNN some legal analysis of all of this and talked about that there are legal precedents for quarantines, and looked at the power to quarantine that was widely used in the U.S. during the influenza pandemic of 1917. He wrote, "Involuntary commitment and quarantine is perfectly legal in every American state." How does Ebola play into that at all? And would you agree that it probably is perfectly legal to do this? We never
you
really.
Know,
I'm sorry.
No, I'm not a constitutional scholar, so it's a little bit difficult for me to comment on that, with a lot of authority. But I think any court looking at it would have to determine whether the guidelines are based on science or not.
Right.
So the quarantines we had during the influenza epidemic, they were based on scientific evidence that it was extremely, extremely virulent. To catch influenza, to catch the flu from someone, you just being in close proximity to them is enough. Them sneezing sends those particles out into the air, and you can get infected. That's not the case with Ebola. So certainly states and the federal government, they have authority to quarantine and isolate people. That's why we have these guidelines. And for people who are symptomatic, the federal government and all the states will use their quarantine powers, and that's 100% constitutional. But I think if the courts were to take up this matter, they'd probably make the distinction between quarantine based on a very, very broad class of people, like just healthcare workers or just people coming from West Africa, versus quarantining based on specific individual characteristics that make you a particular risk for transmitting the disease.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Yevgeny Feyman is a fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress. He writes on healthcare policy, entitlement reform, the Affordable Care Act, the national physician shortage, and the costs of healthcare reform. We're looking at Ebola this hour of the program and what it is we should be doing, what guidelines should we be following when it comes to the quarantine of people who have been in contact with Ebola, those who suffer from Ebola or who have died from Ebola in the West African countries that have been infected. Did it make sense to hold the nurse? She's been getting most of the national attention within her house for 21 days. Or as she said, you're not symptomatic until you show symptoms here. You're not contagious until that point. So instead, it's self-monitoring and making sure that she doesn't have a fever and she remains Ebola-free until November 10th. What do you think? What do you think about the panic that's been surrounding this, about what different states are doing? Has there been overreaction? Has it been political, or has it been people genuinely worried about the health of the people who live in their states, and thus it's better to be extremely cautious and maybe go overboard with quarantine? We welcome your phone calls, and our lines are open for you. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we go to phone calls. And we have many of them coming in. Yevgeny Feyman is our guest, and we start with Sheree from Waupun. Hi, Sheree.
Hi. Thank you, Kathleen, for taking my call.
Sure.
I was telling the screener that I think it's really shameful, the purposeful misinformation that has been spread about Ebola. You would think that after the HIV epidemic that people would take more time to find out about a disease before they go into full panic mode, and there are politicians that are making it seem like it's as simple as catching a cold, when we've only had, what, 5 documented cases in the United States, but yet they're making it seem like it's something we should be running in with our hair on fire about. The spread of misinformation is so disappointing that people in power would want us to be ignorant, and I just don't know what to say about that.
Yevgeny, what do you say about that?
I agree. I think that everyone should try to educate themselves as much as possible on Ebola, but not just Ebola, on the flu, on all sorts of seasonal diseases where a lot of them are preventable, like the flu with the flu shot. It's tough to expect that everyone will take the time to learn about Ebola, though. You have 2/3 of the country that doesn't vote, and a good portion of the country that does vote is probably not as informed as they are. So, as a society, there's a pretty big opportunity cost for us to go and find this kind of information. So people prefer to react in a way that's going to be very, very overbearing, overprotective, but assure them 100% that they're going to be safe from Ebola. Part of it's human nature, unfortunately. There's only so much you can expect. And I've criticized the CDC a little bit, but I think what they've done so far, trying to spread information to hospitals and public health authorities to educate people a little bit better, is pretty much the best we can do, unfortunately.
Thank you, Sheree, for your call. Kathy is next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a daughter who is a research scientist, and some of the people that she, in the lab where she is, have a BS4 certification, which means biosecurity, the highest level you can get. They're the ones that wear the white uniforms, protective gear. Some of them have gone over to Africa to help with it. You cannot get Ebola from somebody coughing on you or touching you. It's not a secondary disease, like, say, the flu or something is. And people are just making way too much of it No one who has actually come in contact with someone who's come in contact with someone who had Ebola has had any negative effects. None of the deaths have been as the result of this secondary or third stage steps. And so much of this reminds me of the reaction with AIDS. I remember, I'm old enough to remember how Ryan White was ostracized.
Yes.
In the school, and you know, that you couldn't come in contact with him. And some of this is just, it's so ridiculous, it's pathetic. And people, I think, as a rule, are very, very scientifically uneducated.
Mm. Yeah, Jenny.
You know, what can I say? I agree. And it's part of the human nature, you know, and I'm hearing again, obviously, the reference to the AIDS epidemic, and I think one thing that drives home the point for me is when AIDS was first discovered, well, HIV, when the virus was first isolated, it was called GRID, gay related immunodeficiency syndrome, and I think that the fact that back then, you know, in the 80s, we thought that there was a disease that could be isolated based on your sexual orientation. You know, we were obviously very ignorant back then, and I'm seeing some of that ignorance now. It's unfortunate. You know, that thinking back to that helps me keep a bit of a level head here. But again, it's difficult to expect everyone to think that same way. People are going to be self-interested, and that's okay. They're worried about themselves. We just have to try to do our best to educate them.
Well, we have this culture that has all these horror films, too, about, and some things have happened in history that have been horrendous, plagues and flu epidemics and horrendous things like that. To have this horrible disease reach our shores, where, I don't know if there's been a case here or not, there's some controversy about that, that's understandable. Oh, we haven't seen this before. This is terrible. On the other hand, you have to keep it in perspective, and you also have to stop this horrendous disease in West Africa, or it will be all over the world, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The only way to deal with Ebola is to deal with it at the source. It's not enough to just treat the cases that we find here. And a big part of that is going to be beyond the public health infrastructure. It's not just something that public health agencies are going to take care of, but we need a vaccine. And it's a little disappointing that throughout all these years, we still don't have a vaccine. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Part of that is the failure of the private sector. Part of it's failure of government to properly incentivize it. But a vaccine is what we need long term. We need the same countermeasures that we've stockpiled for things like anthrax and H1N1 flu.
Thanks very much, Kathy, for your call. Tim in Appleton, hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. The nurse on the East Coast who was quarantined and then had her pet dog quarantined, could you have your guests speak to animals of all types as potential carriers of Ebola? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call.
That's an interesting question. I think the reason that the dog was quarantined was because the assumed method of transmission for Ebola originally and in this most recent outbreak is either through tainted bushmeat. So a lot of the animals that are hunted in West Africa in particular are carriers of the disease. So it's somewhat based on scientific evidence, but I don't think there's any case where we can say for sure that a dog or a cat, a domestic animal, has been found to actually carry Ebola. So it's not clear if they can. It's not clear if they'd have a different strain of the virus. As an example, with the HIV virus, you have entirely different one virus that infects humans and a completely different virus that infects cats, a different virus that infects dogs, and it's not transmittable from animals to humans and vice versa. So it's not clear if it's the same case with Ebola or if it's just one virus that's going to be transmittable between different species.
Thank you very much. It was quite a picture, her release and the release of the dog, too. I mean, both of them look so healthy and so happy to be with each other. And you think about it, what it was like just a couple weeks before and you didn't know what the outcome would be. So this can be cured, certainly. A Facebook message from Jonathan: these quarantines are political fear-mongering. It's a slippery precedent. What's next, being quarantined for the flu?
Well, we, like you mentioned earlier, during the influenza pandemic, we did quarantine people. And we did that because we didn't know very much about it. We had no way of effectively curing it initially or preventing it, besides resorting to public health measures. So, it's going to be political. Unfortunately, you can't expect very much else from politicians. Politicians are political animals, and they're going to respond to what they think are voter incentives. I think the most we can hope for is that as we move forward, these guidelines, the isolation orders, quarantine orders, become more grounded in science than in politics. There's some scientific reasoning for a quarantine under certain circumstances when you're symptomatic, but not under others when you're not symptomatic. That's different than with a flu, but we shouldn't be targeting whole classes of people. I think that's the big slippery slope, where we identify this giant group of people and just say, let's quarantine them because we're afraid.
Mm-hmm. Matt in Sparta, hi.
Hi there. So I'm definitely not a statist. 99% of the time I'm going to say the state should not have the power to detain somebody. But the way I look at it, if you're going to go to Africa to care for Ebola patients, you're obviously a pretty selfless person, and God bless you for that. So why not, when you come back home, be selfless for a little while longer and quarantine yourself to protect your loved ones, protect people you never met. I really don't see the controversy. That's all I had on that, and I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
All right, Matt.
That's a good point in the sense that we should be deferring to healthcare workers in many of these cases, because they're certainly going to be better educated about this than your average politician, and even possibly better educated than some of the epidemiologists who work with the public health authorities, because these healthcare workers, they've been on the front lines. They know the disease much better. They know how to recognize the symptoms much better. So I'm all for letting healthcare workers do self-monitoring if they're non-symptomatic, but there's a difference there when you have them do it themselves versus when you have the state impose the quarantine order, when all science, when the healthcare workers are saying there's no reason for this. It's really important where that quarantine or isolation is coming down from, and I think most healthcare workers are going to be honest enough that if they have the symptoms, if they start thinking that they're a risk, they're going to immediately isolate themselves and call the public health authorities.
Yeah.
I think we should have enough trust in our healthcare workers for that.
So do you think some of the healthcare workers have said, this is asking too much of us, we need to get back to our jobs, et cetera, 21 extra days. Is it unfair to ask them for another 21 days? Would it keep people from going to West Africa, do you think?
Well, that's a tougher question. When we do the 21 days, it's 21 days because that's a full incubation period of Ebola. So based on what we know about the disease, if you're going to have symptoms, if you're going to become contagious, it's going to happen within that 21-day period. And there it gets a little bit hazy. We shouldn't be quarantining someone who's unsymptomatic for any amount of time. We should be requiring that people who are low risk or medium risk try to avoid very crowded spaces. We should definitely be doing that. We should be asking them, if you can, maybe take a car to work or try to avoid commercial transportation when you can. But overall, unless they're symptomatic, going to work is going to be okay for most of them. Going to restaurants is going to be okay. The difference is when you're talking about someone who was in direct contact with bodily fluids from someone who was symptomatic with Ebola. And this is where the details become very important. This is what the CDC guidelines try to differentiate between. There's a huge difference between whether you're just treating someone with Ebola while wearing the protective suit versus if you're treating someone with Ebola who's symptomatic and who vomited on you, even while wearing the suit.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we treat those different types of workers is going to have to be different. There's no way around that.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. Lloyd sent this email. I was amazed to hear Republican politicians increasing people's fear by saying that the virus could change and become transmittable by air.
You know, it's certainly not only Republican politicians that are fear mongering. In New York, it was it came down from our governor Cuomo who just got reelected. So. It's definitely both sides. I think there's certainly always a fear that a disease can mutate. HIV, the virus mutated. It's very different from what we originally isolated, and it continues to mutate. I don't think we have any evidence that Ebola can mutate quite as much as HIV does. But there's been at least one academic paper that has looked at the theoretical possibility of Ebola becoming airborne, and they have pointed out that it's a non-zero possibility, which is to say there's some small probability of that happening. We don't think it's happened yet, but it's certainly possible. When you start treating a disease, so when you actually make it harder for the disease to infect people, to kill people, the disease does tend to mutate. They respond. You know, they're still living things. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Dan in Sioux Falls. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I happen to be a physician myself, and the point I wanted to make was that while there's been fear mongering for sure, and Ebola, not so, you know, transmissibility of Ebola is not as robust as wanted to be advertised on the news. The folks that are going over to West Africa are the highest risk because they are taking care directly of people with Ebola. And when they come home, if not in quarantine, then it's not as though they are just going to the grocery store or doing the things that we expect, hearing that people's civil liberties have been limited. They're going and working in a hospital. In my own life, that would be in a critical care unit. For others, that might be in a clinic. That might be just places where people are now more immunocompromised, and therefore the healthcare providers exposure is high risk. And I would argue that perhaps that the environment they go into, if not in quarantine, is even also high risk. So I think it doesn't seem an unreasonable thing to expect a quarantine in that situation.
But when you say at high risk, isn't that what we've been talking about, that you're not putting somebody at risk, you're not high risk until you're symptomatic?
Right, but we've already had now cases of healthcare providers that have developed symptoms during the course of a regular day, whether that be traveling or whether that be I just got back and I'm meandering around New York. And so while I trust these providers to say, hey, look, I'm symptomatic, and they have all done so, and kudos to them, and I appreciate everything they've done. And as other callers have suggested, their selfless service, incredible. But there is a time frame where I would imagine, and admittedly I have more to learn, and so too do I think all of us, there's much to know, but I still would say that the consequences, should somebody be able to spread Ebola, is that you're in a very high-risk environment. Most of the patients that I take care of are in fact on ventilators. They are themselves immunocompromised, and so with a lot of diseases, you have a double-hit theorem where you might survive one incident, but if you are otherwise not well, then you're not going to be able to defend yourself against diseases. So it, to me, seems like a high-risk environment that you're going into if you are, in fact, a healthcare worker. You're not just out in public. I think that some of this response has certainly been more than needed, and I think that you know, we need to definitely reduce our response to this. I think it's been a lot of fear mongering, but I do want to just kind of make the point. Well, I'm not just going to the grocery store after I come
right
back from West Africa. I'm going.
Okay, all right, Dan. Thanks. You have Jenny.
There's a good point there to be made for hospitals, for providers' offices, for oncology clinics where they may have very high-risk patients. In general, they probably don't want to expose those patients to the potential of getting and any kind of serious infection, whether it's the flu, Ebola, the cold. So I think at a provider level, at a hospital level, at a clinic level, they may very well want to say, you know, look, you've done a great job. We're just going to ask you to hold off coming back to work for 21 days. We'll continue to pay your salary. Just, do what you're going to do there. Follow the guidelines of the CDC or the state has set down. But we just want to make sure that our patients are going to be okay and that there's absolutely no added risk for them. I think for a hospital or for a clinic to say that, it's okay. You just don't want to have this coming down from the top. You don't want to have this coming down from public health authorities because they're not going to make these on a case-by-case basis. They're going to lump someone into a risk category, or they're going to lump a whole group into a risk category, and that's it. And then it applies to everyone there, whereas your workplace, they can make a judgment call. They can decide based on your particular situation.
Well, you have to assume then, don't you, if you're going to have such a policy, that everybody, and I would think that most healthcare workers are honest, but if indeed there are a substantial number who believe that they will not spread the disease if they are not symptomatic, and so they don't want to have to stay in their home for 21 days and be monitored. They are healthcare workers. They can, they say, figure out when they have symptoms, and then it'll be taken care of. So what's to keep a lot of these people from saying, who are coming through Belgium or Luxembourg or whatever to get to the States and just say, no, I didn't come in contact with anybody with Ebola? Don't you think that could happen, too, that you would have more people saying, I'm not going to tell you the truth because you're not listening to the truth?
Absolutely. I think the more difficult we make it for people who have been in areas where Ebola is present, the more difficult we make it for them to get through into our borders, the more likely it is for them to lie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, if someone's coming from West Africa and they're coming through Belgium, and from Belgium they're coming into the U.S., you could look at their passport. You'll see that they have a stamp from an airport in West Africa, and you'll know that they were there. So at the very least, you'll know that they're coming from an area with Ebola. If you know that they're a doctor, if you know that they're traveling with Doctors Without Borders or the WHO, you can safely assume that they're healthcare workers. So even when they might be a little bit less honest than we'd like, we can usually figure out who is and who isn't a healthcare worker. Now, when it comes to exposure, you're right. There's no way around it. If someone says, I have not been exposed to any Ebola patients, or I have not been exposed to a symptomatic Ebola patient's fluids, that's very, very hard to verify. And unfortunately, we do have to rely on healthcare
right.
workers to tell the truth here.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go next to Jerry in Chilton. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
All
Thanks
right.
for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd like to bring it up with all the fear-mongering and the legitimate fear and fanning the flames, a certain bit of equity, and point out that we have no travel restrictions whatsoever on any number of other more virulent, more contagious, more deadly diseases that are out there. H1N1, bird flu. How many people develop flu symptoms? Are they isolated? Do they test for this normally? I don't think so. You know, and there's no equity there. You know, you could be a carrier at any time. You know, but mm-hmm. you don't hear about anything like that. You don't hear about all these wild demands, you know, for protection against those. And even our run-of-the-mill domestic varieties kill, what, 20,000 plus
right.
people a year?
A lot of people, yeah. How many people go to
yeah,
work when they're
and
sick?
It's contagious. Flu certainly is, mm-hmm. and it's killing 20,000 people. Are we isolating them? Are they put in quarantine? Do we monitor their health care workers?
Yep, Jenny.
That's a really good point. For some diseases we do test for in certain circumstances, the ones that we can test for. immigrants who come from certain countries do get tested for TB, for instance, because that's fairly easy to test for. But even then, the test for TB isn't completely accurate. Certain people have just an allergic reaction to the test. Things like H1N1, as I understand, we can't actually test for. When you have those symptoms, oftentimes it looks like the cold or it looks like the regular flu. But it's a really good point. If we're exercising our public health authority to quarantine people with Ebola, which while virulent, it's a horrible, horrible disease and very deadly. It's nowhere near as virulent as the flu, which does kill a lot of people every single year. We don't require every single person in the country to get a flu shot. And I think before we start going down the list of travel ban and quarantine, broad quarantines, you know, if we're going to do something, and I'm not advocating this, but if we're going to do something, then let's require everyone to get flu shots. But we don't do that. We give people that liberty because it's a trade-off we don't want to make, and I think that's perfectly okay.
Yevgeny Feeman is our guest this hour. He is talking about the Ebola quarantines. He's a fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. One line, actually two lines, are now open. If you'd like to join us, our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go next to Isaiah in Lac des Flambeaux. Hi.
Hi, I'm an epidemiologist. I work at the Great Lakes Center Tribal Epidemiology Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my concern is so five people in the United States have had it, and people have died, but not as many as who die from, like, gun violence or cancer or obesity-related issues or any of the things that are killing all of us. And I think so much of the problem is that people see things as controllable or not controllable, and they see Ebola as something out of their control, so they want to try and place or impose as much control as possible, whereas, you know, diabetes or cancer, people sometimes perceive those as more controllable, and so they don't worry about it as much. I kind of would like to hear what the guests
I think that's a valuable comment. You have Jenny.
Yeah, I think that's completely on point. It's it goes back to human nature, where we're afraid of the unknown, where we're afraid of things that we can't control. And I guarantee you, if someone were to go and say that cancer is contagious, you would have people demanding cancer patients be quarantined, even if cancer was only as contagious as Ebola. There's unfortunately nothing we can do about it. Like I said earlier, it's how we expect people to react. This is why we have healthcare workers. That's why healthcare is provided through healthcare providers, through doctors, through physicians, nurses, through specialists. Because as individuals, we just don't have all the necessary information to make proper judgments. So most people, I think, you're going to have some people who are who come down with cold symptoms and run to their doctor thinking it's Ebola. They should rely on their physician to say, you probably don't have Ebola. Just go home, drink some fluids, and sleep a little bit. People generally, I think, rely on their physicians enough, but there's this small vocal minority that's doing a lot of this fear-mongering.
Thank you so much for your call. We go to... Is it Jose or Josie from Beloit?
Hello?
Hi. Who am I talking to?
My name is Jose.
Oh, it's Jose. Hi, Jose.
Hi there. So I have a question regarding pretty simple. It's like short and simple. Is the United States the only country aiding the Ebola outbreaks in the three or four African countries? Or are Latin American countries also sending people to help out? Because I was just wondering how travel would be applied, if at all, to, like, travel restrictions from the Latin American countries that potentially send people and have people coming back from those countries.
Yeah, I know Cuba is sending people. Do you know of others?
I wouldn't be surprised if hospital efforts in Mexico City were trying to do stuff, since people would probably rally together and try to do something like that, potentially.
You have Jenny?
You know, I've really only heard of Cuba sending the doctors over, but the WHO is obviously very involved, and they tend to have international teams of doctors, so different countries can contribute personnel. Doctors Without Borders obviously draws from a huge international regiment of doctors and nurses. You've got a number of other aid groups, so it may not necessarily be specific countries sending a lot of physicians. Maybe not quite as many as the U.S. is, but I think you do have a huge international presence because you have so many aid organizations involved.
Mm-hmm. This story kind of has slipped from the front pages of newspapers. I don't have a sense now of how the efforts are doing in these affected West African countries, what kind of increase we might be seeing in the numbers. It was all over the press for a while, and it's just not there as much anymore. Why is that?
Well, it's an exciting topic at first, I think. It's an exciting topic when you have the CDC coming out with a report that says that you can have over 1 million cases by January 2015. It's a morbidly exciting topic when people think that this might mutate into one of these epidemics that we always see those movies about, The Walking Dead or 28 Days Later. But over time, it certainly becomes less exciting because you're talking about the same thing. You're talking about the death toll obviously increasing. You're talking about the number of cases increasing. When Casey Hickox was quarantined, that drew some more attention. But I think what we're seeing right now is that it's just not as sensational. The death toll and the number of cases, thankfully, has started to actually flatten out a little bit. It's not increasing quite as exponentially as the CDC had predicted in their worst case scenario. So that's definitely a good sign. You obviously also have the midterm elections, at least here in the U.S. So I think that took some steam out of the Ebola messaging. But who knows? Maybe a week from now, it's going to start back up again. Mm.
Thanks to you, Jose. Margie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I just have three quick points. The political overreaction doesn't surprise me, considering these are the same politicians that don't believe the majority of scientists that say that there's climate change issues. And why would they believe the specialists at the CDC and things? They just are acting with gut fear. And also, if people are concerned about their health risk, shouldn't they get their own house in order, stop smoking, lose weight? That is actually a higher percentage of risk for them. And why aren't these same people concerned about health risks of toxic dumping and fracking and the risks to our water supply, which could be devastating in much greater numbers?
Well, that's quite a list. You have Jenny.
that is a list.
Right.
I'd probably disagree with you on that third point about fracking, but that's neither here nor there. But I think you're right about with your second point that people really should focus on their own behavioral risk factors first. If you're eating at McDonald's morning, noon and night, every meal of the day or two meals a day or even every day, you should probably think about changing that. You should probably try to get your 30 minutes of exercise every day, walk 10,000 steps. Those are simple things. People just don't like having to do things. Again, it goes back to that human nature. I hate harping on that, but people don't like having to do things. They prefer complaining about something that's not in their control. When it comes to politicians, I mentioned this earlier. It's not just Republican politicians. You do have Democrat politicians, Democratic states that have imposed some fairly restrictive guidelines again, I bring up New York's Governor Cuomo, who issued the very restrictive quarantine that New York originally had. And Governor Christie, he's certainly not a mainstream Republican. And I think his policies have been the worst.
Yeah.
So you've got a mix across the ideological spectrum, because fear doesn't really have an ideology.
Oh, there's been fear. Yevgeny, thank you very much, as always, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yevgeny Feyman is our guest this hour, and he is talking about the quarantine efforts for Casey Hickox and others. He is a fellow deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you tomorrow. So join us.